Hey there, it's Kathy. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to History of the 90s early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. In April 1993, the cover of the British music magazine Select featured a photo of suede lead singer Brett Anderson. He's pictured in front of a Union Jack backdrop, with one hand behind his head and another on the waistband of his black leather pants. Above Anderson are the bold words, "Yanks go home." Inside the magazine, an article about the state of guitar music in the UK asks the question, "Who do you think you're kidding, Mr. Cobain?" The piece was written by journalist Stuart McConey in the style of an angry letter to Nirvana's frontman. In it, he says, "Go home and take your miserable grunge wear and your self-obsessed lacquer bands with you." No one knew it at the time, but this rallying call was the beginning of a movement that would sweep first through music and then practically every aspect of British culture. I'm Kathy Kinzora, and this is History of the 90s, a podcast about a decade that changed the world. Over the next two episodes, we're looking back at the rise of Britpop and Cool Britannia. Journalist Stuart McConey was inspired to write that 1993 manifesto because he was tired of the attention grunge music was getting in his home country. McConey believed there were so many bands from the UK that were way cooler and making far better music. Bands like Suede, Saint Etienne, Pulp, Denim, and the O'Tours. In his article slash letter, McConey warned Kurt, "These are the boys who will stop your little game. Bands with pride." He used the catch-all term Britpop when referring to this new breed of musician. And it's believed that this was the first time the moniker was seen in print. But it would be another year before it became widely used to describe the music phenomenon sweeping across the UK. One of the bands most associated with the rise of Britpop was made up of Essex-born art school types with what many in the media believed were fake Cockney accents. Blur signed their first record deal in 1990, and a year later had achieved moderate success. In 1991, the band, fronted by Damon Albarn, had a top 10 hit with the single There's No Other Way from their debut album Leisure. But then Blur went back to relative obscurity. Their second album, Modern Life is Rubbish, released in 1993, didn't help. It failed to deliver any big hits, which may have been the result of a young band spending too much time partying instead of focusing on their music. Then suddenly Blur's fortunes changed with the release of this infectious single in March 1994. Girls and Boys, the peppy little song about sexual freedom, raced up the UK music charts, landing in the number 8 spot. Soon, critics went from calling Blur indie losers to hailing the foursome as one of the most important British bands of the 90s. By the time Blur's third album, Park Life, was released in May 1994, there was so much hype surrounding the band that the record entered the charts at number one, outselling Pink Floyd's 1994 release, The Division Bell, 3-1. Blur reveled in telling tales that exposed the hopeless conformity of UK life, following the well-worn path forged by many other middle and working-class rockers like The Kinks and The Who. The songs on Park Life offered a wry observational look at Britain in the 1990s by creating what Albarn called the equivalent of little films. He told a reporter in 1994, their songs were about people trapped in their own ordinary worlds and their futile attempts to escape. Albarn believed his band's music allowed listeners to experience life in suburban England in the same way gangster rap did for downtown LA. In addition to Boys and Girls, Park Life includes songs about aimless housewives, bored civil servants, and distracting bank holidays. And of course, there is this song that for many is emblematic of the entire Britpop movement.
Oh,
The title song Park Life was the third single off the album. And although you heard Damon Albarn in that clip, the majority of the song is actually a monologue spoken by Phil Daniels, a well-known English actor who appeared in a bunch of films, including the 1979 British movie Quadrophenia, which is based on The Who's rock opera of the same name. On Park Life, Daniels provides the voice of the habitual voyeur who entertains the listener with his thoughts on the general public going hand in hand through their park life. In concert, the song was a favorite, as rowdy fans screamed out Park Life after each verse. Blur's energetic frontman, Damon Albarn, often bounced across the stage in his Fred Perry polo shirts and Adidas trainers. He was the new face of British pop. Backing him up on stage was guitarist Graham Coxon. The pair met as schoolmates in Colchester and quickly bonded over a love of music. Coxon went on to study fine art at Goldsmiths, where he met the rest of the band, bass player Alex James and drummer Dave Rowntree. Albarn spent a year at drama school before dropping out, deciding post-secondary education wasn't for him. He joined Coxon in London, and together with James and Rowntree, they formed a band they called Seymour. In 1990, Seymour was signed to Food Records, and under pressure from the record company, changed their name to Blur. When the band finally made it big in 1994, Albarn quickly became a bit of a heartthrob, but his many female fans were disappointed to learn that Albarn was spoken for. He began dating fellow musician Justine Frischmann in 1991, and by the time Park Life took over British pop, they were living together in the shishi London neighborhood of Kensington. Before meeting Albarn, Frischmann played guitar in the British rock band Suede and dated lead singer Brett Anderson. Now she fronted the mostly female band Elastica, which in 1994 was being called the band to watch, even though they hadn't even released a debut record yet. With so much attention on Elastica and Blur, Frischmann and Albarn were being called the new Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull, who epitomized rock glamour 30 years earlier. Meanwhile, Blur wasn't the only band lighting up the British music scene in 1994. On April 11th, a much-talked-about new rock band from Manchester released their first single. Oasis crashed onto the British music charts with the song Supersonic entering at number 31. It was followed by two other hit singles, Shaker Maker, which peaked at number 11, and Live Forever, which landed the band their first top 10 hit. Live Forever was a breath of fresh air and the polar opposite to the music coming out of the Seattle grunge scene, which by now had been devastated by the death of Kurt Cobain a few months earlier. UK music critics were soon calling the two brothers behind Oasis rock and roll gods. Liam and Noel Gallagher grew up in the working-class Manchester suburb of Burnage, where they met the three other members of the band. Guitarist Paul Bonehead Arthurs, drummer Tony McCarroll, and bassist Paul Gwigsy McGuigan. After spending 18 months rehearsing and gigging around Manchester, they had no manager, no label, and no cash. On a whim, they decided to support a friend's band in Glasgow, Scotland, but neglected to inform anyone that they were coming. So when they showed up at the club, the surprise promoter told them to get lost. But legend has it, he changed his mind when Oasis threatened to burn the place down. Turns out Alan McGee, the president of the indie label Creation Records, was in the audience that night and immediately signed Oasis to a 6-album deal. The band, which was compared to Manchester groups The Stone Roses and Happy Mondays, got their name from a bar where Manchester City football team supporters like to congregate. And like football's infamous hooligans, Oasis was also known for getting into trouble even before their debut album dropped. In March 1994, everyone in the band, except Noel, was thrown in jail after getting into a drunken brawl on a cross-channel ferry en route to a gig in Amsterdam. Soon after, they were banned from the Columbia Hotel in West London for trashing a room. And true to form, the Gallagher brothers were already known for their contentious relationship, which often led to fisticuffs in front of journalists. In August 1994, Noel explained to the Guardian newspaper that as the group's songwriter, it meant Oasis was essentially his band, so he was in charge. When speaking of his brother, Noel said, quote, When people interview him, he's not a writer and he can't talk about the music. He can only talk about himself and how many birds he shagged and how many tables he's thrown across the bar. Even though Liam didn't write the lyrics, he still looked impossibly cool on stage when he sang them. With his shaggy hair and round sunglasses, he often stood motionless while singing, occasionally flexing a finger to rattle a tambourine. He exuded a cocky attitude that was reflected in many of his media interviews. Before their much-anticipated debut album was released, Liam boasted that Oasis would likely be the most important band in the world. He said, quote, "If none of us dies, then we'll be the next Beatles." Thanks to all the hype, When Definitely Maybe was finally released on August 29, 1994, it broke the all-time British record for first-week sales of a debut album, selling 150,000 copies. That killed the previous record, held by Welcome to the Pleasure Dome, released in 1984 by Frankie Goes to Hollywood. The Oasis album entered the British album chart at number one, knocking off the new album by the three tenors. 1994 was a tsunami wave of Britpop, and another band riding high was Pulp. The arty, effeminate sound and style of Pulp couldn't have been more different than Oasis and Blur. But it's important to point out that Britpop was a movement, not a sound, so many of the bands caught up in the frenzy sounded very different. Following a decade of relative obscurity for Pulp, the Sheffield-born band was suddenly all the rage in England. Fronted by flamboyant singer Jarvis Cocker, Pulp was called the most fashionable band in Britain by the music magazine NME. The 6'4" Cocker, who often pranced around the stage dressed in head-to-toe black velvet and platform heels, was compared to David Bowie. After three indie albums in the 1980s, Pulp released their first major label record on Island Records, called His and Hers, in June 1994. It included the hit single Do You Remember the First Time, based on Cocker's experience losing his virginity. A gawky, androgynous sex symbol, Cocker's lyrics often dealt with adolescent sexual frustrations. Take, for example, the song Babies, which was first released as a single in 1992, then re-released 2 years later. In it, Cocker sings in his deep Johnny Cash-like voice about hiding in a wardrobe, watching his girlfriend's sister having sex with a boy after school. Backed by Candida Doyle on keyboards, Steve Mackey on bass, Russell Sr. and Mark Webber on guitar, as well as Nick Banks on drums, Pulp was a massive hit with fans and critics who predicted even greater success was yet to come. And they were right. In May 1995, Pulp released a single that today remains a defining song for the entire Britpop movement. Despite the glossy pop sound, Common People is a working-class anthem, a hilarious satire of downward mobility that tells the story of a rich woman who loves slumming with, you guessed it, common people. It entered the charts at number two and propelled Pulp into the Premier League of pop. The next month, in June 1995, Pulp sealed their place in history with what was called one of the best performances ever at Glastonbury, when the band stepped in at the last minute to replace the Stone Roses. The five-day festival is regarded as a major event in British culture, and in 1995, Pulp had the pleasure of performing on the Pyramid Stage in front of an estimated 100,000 common people. The band's performance was a landmark moment for Jarvis Cocker, who told BBC's Desert Island Discs in 2005, that was the event that made the success a concrete fact. Meantime, as 1995 was progressing, it was becoming clear that there was growing resentment between two of the biggest bands on the Britpop scene, Blur and Oasis. Author Daniel Rachel, whose book Don't Look Back in Anger charts the rise and fall of Cool Britannia, says it wasn't always that way.
Prior to that, and it's hugely important that there's a good 18 months of Blur and Oasis records being released, where the bands were supporting one another. Liam went to see Blur and liked them. When Blur won awards in 94 when they won the four awards, the Brits, they said that we should be sharing this with Oasis. There was a good camaraderie between the two bands and no sense that there was going to be a competition.
The tension between the two bands was partly thanks to the media, which pitted the posh Southern kids against the rough working class Northerners, playing into a long-standing divide in the UK. But it also didn't help that Liam Gallagher insulted Damon Albarn to his face after the Oasis song Some Might Say went number one in the spring of 1995. Albarn went to the band's celebration party to congratulate them, but according to the Blur singer, when he got there, Liam came over and yelled, "Number effin' one," right in Albarn's face, who thought, "Okay, we'll see." That interaction might explain what happened next. Both bands released their newest singles on the same day, August 17th, 1995. And it wasn't an accident. Damon Albarn pressured Blur's label Food Records to change the original release date of Country House, the lead single from their fourth album, to the same day as the Oasis single Roll With It from their newest album, What's the Story, Morning Glory. This move forced a head-to-head battle between the bands, something Daniel Rachel says is rare in the music industry.
Ideally, you do what the Beatles and the Stones did in the 60s, where you talk to one another's manager and you make sure that the releases are so far apart that both bands can enjoy a number one record.
The British press dubbed the showdown the Battle of Britpop, billing it the greatest pop rivalry since the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. In the lead-up, an NME cover declared the coming chart battle a British heavyweight championship. Daniel Rachel says part of the reason it got so much coverage was because it was a slow news month since Parliament was in recess.
Which means that the majority of newspapers don't have anything important to write about. So they look for a story, which hence, in the week when that battle happened, it made it onto the BBC 9 o'clock news as a feature. Now that would never happen in the political season.
Insults were hurled back and forth between the two bands, fueling the frenzy. Oasis accused Blur of producing Chaz and Dave chimney sweep music, referring to a very uncool British pop duo. While Blur hit back by mocking Oasis for being too predictable and boring. Damon Albarn called them Oasis Quo, a reference to the 60s rock band Status Quo, which was known for playing the same three chords over and over again. Daniel Rachel says the entire country appeared to be swept up in the Britpop battle, and in some cases, things got ugly.
And all these prejudices that define British life, which is a class prejudice essentially, came to play. There was some humour for sure, but it actually brought out the worst in people's latent prejudice, which is dividing people according to class and with working class considered lower than a middle class.
It was a close race, but in the end, Blur won the day with their song Country House, which topped the UK charts with sales of 274,000 copies in the first week, while the Oasis song Roll With It made number two with 216,000 copies sold. The Battle of Britpop bolstered single sales, resulting in the best week for sales in a decade. But it created a massive wedge between the two bands that would continue for quite a while. When Blur's album The Great Escape was released in September 1995, Noel Gallagher famously told the Guardian newspaper that he hopes Damon Albarn and Blur guitarist Graham Coxon would catch AIDS and die because, quote, "I effing hate them too." Meantime, Pulp, which typically let the lad bands bash it out, released a two-song single in that same month, and once again landed in the number two spot on the British music charts, further cementing their position as one of Britain's most popular bands. But the CD cover for Misshapes and Sorted for Ease and Whiz generated some high-profile controversy because the artwork on it included diagrams on how to make a secret paper wrapper to hide your drugs. Jarvis Cocker maintained that Sorted for Ease and Whiz, which is a reference to ecstasy and amphetamines, was actually an anti-drug song that looked back at the failed utopia promised by the rave scene. Pulp's album, Different Class, was released on October 30th, 1995. And in addition to Common People, Misshapes, and Sordid, there was also the sinister I Spy, which tells the tale of a man who hires a private eye to catch his cheating wife. Critics called Different Class a masterpiece, a class-conscious concept album populated by posh girls and poor boys. Far Out magazine has described it as high art of the common people, something akin to Andy Warhol. Fans loved it too. Different Class, which entered the UK music charts at number one, went on to sell over 1.3 million copies in Britain. And it also won the coveted Mercury Prize in 1996, which honors the best album of the year by an artist from the UK and Ireland. While Pulp was dazzling British music critics and winning accolades, and Blur and Oasis were battling it out for supremacy on the UK music charts, the Britpop scene wasn't really breaking through in the much-coveted US music market. Only one British musical act made it onto Billboard's list of top 30 albums in 1994. And it wasn't one of the new Britpop bands tearing up the charts in the UK. It was Pink Floyd with their record The Division Bell. Compare that to 1966 during the British invasion, when eight of Billboard's top 30 albums were by UK acts, like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Then there was the 80s, when British acts like The Police, The Clash, and Duran Duran made it big. But in the early 90s, very few British acts had made even the slightest impression in America, especially those deemed Britpop. Radiohead and the Cranberries were making the most inroads, but Blur, Suede, Oasis, Echo Belly, and Pulp were having a really hard time getting established in the US, where despite the death of Kurt Cobain in 1994, grunge and grunge-adjacent music still dominated. For sure, many British bands acted like they didn't care about conquering the US market, but their record labels certainly did, because they wanted to sell more records and make more money. In a 1995 interview in The Guardian, Dick Green, co-founder of Creation Records, which was home to Oasis, said the Gallagher brothers were their one big hope to change the whole situation. But in fact, one of the Britpop bands that broke first in the US was actually Elastica, the group fronted by Justine Frischmann, girlfriend of Blur singer Damon Albarn. Elastica's eponymous debut album was released in March 1995. And it went straight to number one in Britain, becoming the fastest-selling debut album, a record previously set less than a year earlier by Oasis when they released Definitely Maybe. Elastica's album contained 15 loud and fast tracks, including the previously released single, Connection. Following the release of their debut, Elastica, for a short time, became the most celebrated Britpop act in the US, trouncing all the rest. While Blur and Oasis were duking it out in the media, Elastica toured incessantly in the US, building a substantial following. This led to a bidding war among US labels, which resulted in a jackpot deal for Elastica with Geffen Records. But it wouldn't be long before things began to unravel for Frischmann and her band. In the meantime, Oasis stopped fighting with Blur long enough to finally fulfill expectations and became an international success story with their soon-to-be karaoke and campfire classic, Wonderwall, released in October 1995. Because baby, and if you've ever wondered what a Wonderwall is, you're not alone. That's because no one really knows. Noel Gallagher just liked the way it sounded. And he actually borrowed it from the George Harrison album Wonderwall Music, which was the soundtrack for the 1968 psychedelic British film also called Wonderwall. The Oasis song reached number one on the Billboard Alternative Chart in both Canada and the US, while their album What's the Story, Morning Glory peaked at number four on the Billboard 200. By 1996, Oasis was so big that the Gallagher brothers were featured on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, which said the hard-drinking, groupie-shagging, drug-snorting louts had conquered America. Through it all, the brothers were still picking fights with each other and anybody else who got in their line of sight. When Wonderwall won for Best Video at the 1996 Brit Awards, In Excess singer Michael Hutchence presented them the trophy and stepped to the side. Noel then leaned into the mic and said, "They really shouldn't let has-beens hand out awards." After a short pause, he added, "I'm rich and you're not." Noel wasn't the only one causing a fuss at the Brit Awards that year. Jarvis Cocker from Pulp had his own moment on the stage when he interrupted Michael Jackson during an over-the-top performance of his Earth song. Midway through the nearly 10-minute production that included crying children dressed in rags, Cocker ran onto the stage, plugged his nose, then bent over while waving his hand near his butt like he was spreading a wafting smell around. Later in a TV interview, Cocker said he felt ill watching Jackson do what he called his distasteful Jesus act, so he decided to do something to demonstrate his true feelings. While the 96 Brit Awards were definitely a memorable moment, the pinnacle of the Brit pop era, for many, was the Nebworth Festival in 1996. That's when Oasis made history over a wild weekend in August. As the five band members took the stage for their first of two shows on the stately grounds of a Tudor-era country house, they were greeted with a roar on a scale never heard at a concert on British soil before. They stood side by side with arms around shoulders, owning the biggest stage of their lives. Liam Gallagher raised a drink over his head while his brother Noel grabbed the microphone. Gazing out at the sea of people, he said,
"This is history! This is history! Right here, right now, this is history!"
And it turns out, Noel was right. Oasis played to 250,000 people over two nights, which remains the biggest UK live shows in the history of rock.
It was a cultural gathering of 250,000 people, and it felt amazing to be there. And you were among, in the same way as when Stone Roses played Spike Island, maybe in the same way as the great festivals of the 60s, you know, that marked the generation for what it was, Woodstock or Monterey. Nebworth was really, really important.
Daniel Rachel says that at the time, it felt like many more great moments were yet to come for the Britpop movement. But as it turned out, the end was just around the corner. And before we get to that, it's important to point out music wasn't the only area of British life that was undergoing a massive rebirth in the mid-90s. The film industry was booming with movies like Trainspotting. The fashion world was alive with fresh talent like Alexander McQueen. And a new wave of young British artists were taking the art world by storm. Coming up on the next episode of History of the 90s, we'll look back at how the UK reclaimed its position at the artistic center of the world during an era known as Cool Britannia. And you'll find out how and why it all came to an end. Thanks for listening to this episode on some of the great musicians of Britpop. And thanks to my special guest, award-winning author Daniel Rachel. In addition to being in the 90s band Rachel's Basement, he has written several great books, including Don't Look Back in Anger, The Rise and Fall of Cool Britannia Told by Those Who Were There. I'll put the details in the show notes in case you want to check it out. This topic has been suggested by several listeners over the past few years, including James Wernham, Matt Goodison, Clements, and Baby Cobra. Thanks to each of you for the idea. If you have a suggestion for an episode, please let me know. You can reach me through social media. We're on Instagram at That 90s Podcast and on Facebook at 1990s History. Or you can email me at 90s@curiouscast.ca. That's 90s@curiouscast.ca. This episode was hosted and written by me, Kathy Kinzora. Our producer is Dila Velasquez, and sound design and final production is by Rob Johnston. See you next time for more History of the 90s.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.